So this evening we're going to continue with looking at the Four Noble Truths, but we've got to the Fourth Noble Truth, but there's so much there that I've broken it into three nights, so that this week and the next two Thursdays we'll work our way through the Fourth Noble Truth, and then we'll have covered all four of the Four Noble Truths. And so the Fourth Noble Truth, remember, is the Eightfold Path. It's the, if the Buddha had stopped at Noble Truth number three, said, "Oh, just stop craving. It's okay. Just stop craving, and everything will be fine." We'd all be in a lot of trouble. But he then went on to lay out the Eightfold Path, which was, basically, and here's how to do that. Here's the instructions. That come, and then for the next 40 years of his life, he continued to, give information and teach, and give instructions, always coming back to the Four Noble Truths, in sometimes in ways that weren't so obvious, but everything is just a reflection on this original teaching. So, the first two steps on the Eightfold Path, these are sometimes called the wisdom factors. They're the and they're how do we start? How do we start on this path? What motivates us, and how do we do it? So these two are wise understanding and wholesome intention. And wise understanding is also sometimes called wise view. And there's this really interesting sutta where basically the Buddha says, this is the Mahakatarissaka Sutta, the Great 40, it's sometimes called. And the Buddha basically says, everything is based on right view. With right view is what gets us going and keeps us going. And so I want to read little bits of the sutta here. And I'm just going to read a few verses. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. And what, bhikkhus, is right view? Right view, I say, is twofold. There is right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, and ripening acquisitions. And there is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, and a factor of the path. So here, right at the beginning, he's already speaking about absolute reality and relative reality. And so when he talks about it's twofold. There's right view that pertains to how we understand and live in the world of relative reality, and there's also right view that applies more directly to absolute reality. And he goes on. And what, bhikkhus, is right view that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? There is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and results of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are in the world good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is right view affected by taints, partaking of merit, and ripening in acquisitions. So, first off, What a mouthful, right? And what does this all mean? This is all like code in a way. And so I want to just look at some of these things he's talking about here. First of all, he's talking about the results of good and bad actions. So right view comes right down to understanding the nature of karma, the nature of the fact that everything we do, every act of body and speech and mind has fruits, which he keeps talking about as well. And it's those fruits that determine how things go in this life. And if you want to look at it that way, also in future lives, it's not necessary. Just look at this life. Some look at the things you've done in this life that have affected how your life has turned out now. That's just the law of karma functioning, basically. And don't worry about accepting the idea of reincarnation and future lives. It's not something you have to believe. There's no dogma. But what I would ask you to do is simply to suspend disbelief. Don't believe, but don't not believe. Just suspend disbelief and let the teachings in the path and your own practice take you to an understanding of it over time. That's the best I can suggest. And then the next thing he says here, he says, there is mother and father. What is, here he is talking about the fact that we were born. And he's talking about the debt we owe them simply because they brought us into the world and raised us. And this can be difficult to understand and absorb, especially if your relationship is or was a difficult one. And it's like we somehow, it's just like if your parents are still around, you think, oh, I should share the Dhamma with them. This is such a great thing, I should tell them all about it and really, turn this into something we can share. And the danger of that is if you're not careful, it turns into like proselytization. It turns into trying to convince them, trying to make them something they're not. And you don't need to do that. We just need to sort of be who we are and let how this practice affects you and how this practice presents through how you live your life. That's what's important. And that'll speak volumes. And they may then ask you questions about it, but don't feel like you have to sort of explain the whole thing. That it just will cause difficulties. And this goes not only for your mother and father, by the way, but for other members of your family. It's just so, oh, you just want to share it because it's so wonderful. Just be an example of what it's like to be a practitioner. And that'll affect them. Just that all by itself. Without them even knowing that you're a practitioner, perhaps. It's not necessary. Then he says, the last section here, he says, oh, and by the way, understand that there are right now in the world people who are enlightened. That there are recluses, as the words he uses here, that there are virtuous recluses who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and other worlds. Is they're saying there are people right now in this world that are enlightened. Don't ever forget that. And I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein's book. mindfulness here. I got a bunch of bookmarks there. This is where he's talking about right view in his book, Mindfulness. Noble right view, which leads onward to nibbana, is described in two ways in the suttas. First is described as the wisdom factor of mind. It illuminates what arises so that we can know and understand things as they really are. The arising of wisdom is like a turning on a light in a darkened room. In the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, wisdom is one of the 25 beautiful mental factors. Second, noble right view is described in terms of objective content, that is, what wisdom discovers as it illuminates our experience. The Buddha equates this liberating right view specifically to the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And what, monks, is right view? It is, monks, the knowledge of dukkha, the knowledge of the origin of dukkha, the knowledge of the cessation of dukkha, the knowledge of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha. This is right view. The Buddha is so clear about emphasizing the importance of right view in promoting the welfare of beings. This is from another sutta. Bhikkhus, I do not see even a single thing on account of which unarisen wholesome qualities arise and arisen wholesome qualities increase and expand so much as right view. Mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths is, in fact, the last set of instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is like what he's saying is, here in the Satipatthana Sutta, the very last thing we have to be able to understand from a meditative point of view, the last meditative instructions he gives are to really understand the Four Noble Truths in a non-intellectual way. And that all arises out of right view. So it seems like this might be important, I guess, is what I have to say. Okay, let me just shift my bookmarks here. Okay, so that's, but here's another interesting thing. I'm going to read the next couple of verses here. And what, bhikkhus, is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The wisdom, the faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, the investigation of state's enlightenment factor, the path factor of right view is one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right view that is noble, taintless, a factor of the path. One makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. This is one's right effort. Mindfully, one abandons wrong view, and mindfully, one enters upon and abides in right view. This is right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right view, that is, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. So he's already equating and seeing how the different steps in the Eightfold Path are interrelated. And actually the rest of this sutta that goes on for quite a few pages keeps coming back to that idea of looking at things from different points of view. But I think what's important here is that right view is a practice. I mean, this is exactly what he's saying here. He's saying that we have to practice right view. We have to keep being aware all the time about where we're coming from when we make choices. Is it coming from a place of wholesome view, of wise view, or are we sort of veered off in some odd direction. And we do that through mindfulness. As we look at the right view, then we're mindful of what the basis of that view is. And that's what mindfulness allows us to do, to actually see, oh, this is coming from a place where it isn't too skillful, that I've gone off on the wrong track here. The power of mindfulness. And this also points to another thing I think is also equally important. And that is that this path isn't like a straight line. It's not like a path, like, you know, you start here, start at A and 1 and go to 8 and then you're done, right? It's really, the image I like best is it's a spiral. You know, you start off, you wouldn't have started off this practice at all if you didn't have some level of wise understanding. If you didn't have some level of wise view, you wouldn't have bothered to go to all the trouble of doing this if you didn't have some level of that already. And as we practice and as we deepen our practice and we deepen our mindfulness and we deepen our concentration and we learn how to be skillful with our effort, we just come back around right to the beginning again. Oh, now we see what right view means or wholesome view means, right understanding means on another level. And we go a little deeper and then we spin around the spiral again and again and again. And that's the beauty of this path, is it keeps developing in that way. So we don't just like, okay, I've got right view, that's it, I've taken care of that one, now I can go on. We keep coming back and seeing things a little more clearly, a little more deeply, and we go, oh, never thought of it quite that way before. You know, that's literally what we'll see ourselves saying in our minds sometimes. Never quite saw that before. And the other thing about this, what passages I just read, is it's like, oh, right view leads to enlightenment. This practice, this entire practice, is about moving towards enlightenment. And we can't ever forget that either. It's like, we can't be satisfied with something less, like being a good person or being happier, you know, which is how the commercialized versions of mindfulness sometimes turn this practice into just that. Right? So you have to be careful that that's going to happen. Yes, those goals of being a good person and being happier are going to come as fruits of the practice naturally, but we can't lose sight that they're just steps along the way. They're bonuses that we get along the way that really, it's mindfulness and just being moving towards liberation. That's what the practice is for. That's why we practice. That's what it is. And we have to keep that in mind as well. And this means that we have to not be satisfied with something less. And whether, you know, it's like, even though we understand, well, you know, it may not happen this lifetime. I mean, we can't sort of go, well, if I don't become enlightened this lifetime, what a waste. That's not realistic either. But it's like, can I gain something by having that as my goal? And he talks about you do this through mindfulness. And remember that the word mindfulness is a translation of the Pali word sati. Another translation of the word sati is just remembering. And this is one of the things we have to remember. We have to remember over and over and over again, oh, this practice is about liberation. That's where, you know, I get these other benefits. Yes, it leads to generally more happiness and being a better person. Absolutely. But that's not the end point of the practice at all. Don't ever forget that. One other thing, you know, he talked about, you know, the problems of wrong view. There's another teaching called the 10 Unwholesome Acts of Body, Speech, and Mind, which I, when I came across, I thought, oh, what an interesting teaching. And here's the most interesting part. The last thing on that list of 10, you know, there's three unwholesome acts of mind. The last of those is wrong view. Just that, wrong view is an unwholesome state of mind because it leads to all the other problems that arise in this practice. It just gets in the way. So I want to read some more Joseph here just because he explains some of these things. And he's talking here about wrong view. What a surprise. And he's saying, why does the Buddha make such a strong declaration about this wrong view of self, which is the ultimate wrong view, the view that we are somehow separate? It's just the view. And the Buddha keeps coming back and emphasizing this particular wrong view over and over again. It is because so many of our unwholesome actions with their attendant results are born from it. As long as this view is the central and understanding of our lives, as it is for most people, we spend energy and effort in gratifying the self, defending it, holding on to it. And yet all of this potent karmic activity is revolving around something that isn't even there. This is the obscuring power of delusion. A few examples show how our ordinary way of viewing experience is unknowingly strengthening wrong view. I feel happy. I feel miserable. And I am delighted are all wrong views about mental feelings. I remember the first time I read that sentence, I was going, what? We take what is impersonal, the feeling tones, to be I or mine. I want to do this, we see this, to hear this, to go there, are all delusions about the mental factor of desire to do. We add the I and mine to the working of an impersonal factor. I make an effort, or I have concentration, is wrong view about those two qualities. We can analyze almost every aspect of our daily life and see how we are continually identifying with these different states of mind and emotion that arise and creating and strengthening the sense of self in the process. So how do we deal with this? This is like this thing that, you know, like, how can I, you know, something arises and I think, and it's really pleasant, and I think, oh, I feel happy. If we can somehow in our mind change the languaging to happiness has arisen. No I. So as soon as we use the word I or me or mine, we're creating a sense of self, literally, and reinforcing the sense that we have a separate self. So, I mean, there is even, you know, I know people who have gone around for just for a day, which this is an interesting experiment. See if you can spend a whole day and not say I, me, or mine. Or write it or type it in your, you know, not use that, those words at all. It's actually quite amazing how often we use those words. And every time we do that, we're creating this self. Now, it's like, you know, in terms of relative reality, sure, that those things are all true. There, I exist and I have to function in the world of relative reality. So, you know, it's pretty difficult to sort of not ever say those words again. You know, that would be maybe too much to ask, you know, unless you're going to go live in the forest and be a monastic all by yourself or a hermit or something. But just, it's interesting to experiment just to see how powerful that habit is. Just those words are so easily repeated yet again and again and again. Anyhow, I just find this fascinating. And so everything arises out of wrong view. All of our problems arise out of wrong view is one way to look at it. That's why right view, wholesome view, wise understanding is so important. And that's why we keep coming back to it over and over and over again and seeing more deeply into it over time. And this is, that's the way this practice works in a sense. Okay, so that's wise understanding or wise view. That's the first of the steps on the Noble Eightfold Path. The second one is wise intention. So once we have wholesome view, we are naturally led to the second step. I mean, it's like, okay, I see clearly because I have wise view, I have wise understanding that I need to do something. I can't just stay stuck in this place of where our culture leaves us all the time and where our mental habits have placed us over and over and over again. I have to do something. So I have to form an intention. You know, it's skillful thought or intention. That's the next step on the Eightfold Path. We clearly see the need to practice diligently. But how do we do that? We cultivate renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. Oh, wholesome mind states. You know, how do we actually come to a place where we have wise intention? Intention is just a neutral mental arising that must occur before every act of body and speech. Before I say a word or wave my hand in the air or whatever it is, there has to be the intention first. Without intention, nothing happens. So intention in itself is neutral. So we have to have wholesome intention, wise intention. We have to see that what we're intending makes sense as opposed to being unwholesome intention, which is pretty easy to fall into as well. There is a classic story in the sutta about this guy, Angulimala. Anguli means fingers, and mala is a necklace. And he was actually apparently quite a famous murderer and brigand. And every time he would murder somebody, he'd chop off one of their fingers and add it to his necklace. So the story goes. And he had, over time, accumulated a necklace of 999 fingers. And he decided that last finger, because he wanted to get to 1,000, had to be a really special, it couldn't just be any old finger, it had to be a really special finger. And he'd heard about the Buddha. And he was going, ah, that's the finger I need. I need one of his fingers to complete my mala. You know, the mala is a ritual tool that you use in meditation. So Angulimala has decided he's and because the Buddha happens to be in the neighborhood. And so the Buddha's leaving the villages and heading down this particular path, and the villagers are saying, no, don't go there. That's where Angulimala, hangs out in the forest that way. Don't take that path. The Buddha's going, no, it's okay. And he's going down the path, and Angulimala sees him and starts to run after him. And the Buddha just keeps walking along. And no matter how hard Angulimala runs, how fast he runs, he can't catch up with the Buddha. And the Buddha's just walking along. And he keeps trying harder and harder and harder to catch him. And finally he says, hey, wait, how can you possibly be doing this? How can you just keep walking along, Dad, and I can't catch you? It doesn't make sense. And the Buddha stopped, and the Buddha gave him some basic teaching. And then Angulimala was like, oh, I see. And he became one of the Buddha's disciples. He's had an unwholesome intention, and through the teachings of the Buddha and his own, he could see that the Buddha was someone really special, because no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't get that finger. He couldn't catch him to get the finger. And his whole intention changed. And he actually took vows and became, according to the story, eventually an enlightened being. Both through practice. He had a rough time. This is another interesting part of the story. Because he, was known to be such a rotten guy, and he'd killed 990 people, so a lot of people really hated him, basically. And he would go on alms rounds in his bowl, and he'd have his bowl, and basically, when you go on alms round as a mic, you hold your bowl in front of you, your eyes are downcast, and you walk through the village, and what people put in your bowl, that's what you get. And he'd come walking through a village where he killed some people, and people were putting pieces of dung into his bowl, and twigs and rotten things, and just and he complained to the Buddha. He said, look, this isn't fair. I'm supposed to, now I have right intention. I've become a monk. You got to tell these people to stop doing this. And the Buddha said, no, this is the results of your past actions. This is something you have to live with and understand, that those actions, you can't just sort of turn the switch and now I'm a good guy. You have to live with the results of your actions that come earlier in your life. And Gulimala learned to actually do that. So that is just an interesting story about intention. Like, from talk about an unwholesome tension. Let's kill the Buddha and chop off one of his fingers for my necklace. I can't think of a less wholesome intention than that. But just like that. So, but the Buddha lists these three things as to bring about wise intention, wholesome intention. We need to cultivate renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. Well, the first one of these, renunciation, doesn't have a good name in our culture. You say the word renunciation, and people basically go, ooh, who wants to do that? It's not going to be fun at all. It's a classic story. A guy is, it's like one of those classic cartoons where this guy's climbing up a mountain, and he gets up to this little plateau, and there's a wise man sitting there, meditating. And guy, well, yeah, I found the wise man on the mountain, and he goes up to him and he says, oh, great wise man, how can I reach enlightenment? And the wise man says, follow the path of renunciation. And the climber sort of pauses, and then he looks sort of around and says, Anyone else up here I can talk to? No, not anything but the path of renunciation, right? And at some level, this is justified in our culture. There's been a lot of quote renunciates who have been, shall we say, anything but renunciates, and have acted really poorly, you know, both in the yoga world and in the Buddhist world and in the Catholic world. Pick a world of practice. There's been renunciates who have been less than pure, shall we say. I won't bore you with the details. And it's sort of the idea of renunciation itself is a little off-putting, because we keep hearing these stories and it's like we blame it on renunciation. When in fact, these people have just been acting out their human nature and, you know, using renunciation as a sort of like a screen. You know, like, if I'm pretend I'm a renunciate, then people will revere me and take care of me. And doesn't work. For a lot of people, complete renunciation, you know, is not a very successful path. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And the other part is, you know, our culture glorifies that you getting everything you can and not doing anything that isn't pleasurable, that's the way things should be. Which is, of course, not too much renunciation there. It's like, I just want all the good stuff. I don't want any of the unpleasant stuff. That's the opposite of renunciation. And that's what our culture encourages us to do. So, renunciation requires, having right intention requires that we renounce what is normally deemed to be the source of happiness, getting stuff. Right? That's how we're taught that getting stuff in the broadest sense, I mean, stuff, I mean, like, physical stuff, but also like a good job and a wonderful life and a nice house or whatever, you know, a wonderful partner, blah, blah, blah. We have to renounce that. We have to renounce that idea that the way to be happy is just to get all the good stuff and not have any of the unpleasant stuff. And it's like, oh, I actually have to accept the fact that sometimes things are going to be not so great. Oh, this is called accepting reality as it really is, seeing things as they really are. You know, life is full of ups and downs, and sometimes you're going to have the great stuff, and sometimes you're going to get stuff that ain't so great. And that's just the way things are. And just so renouncing the idea that we'll be happy if we just get all only good stuff. That's a huge renunciation, because it's like we're seeing things as they really are and accepting, oh, this is how things are. Sometimes it's not going to be so great. You know, I'm going to get old, he says, raising his hand. You know, I have to spend all my time fiddling. Every morning I have to fiddle with my hearing aids to get them in just right and remember that they should be charged when I go to bed. And, you know, I'm going someplace, I have to pack my hearing aid charger with me when I go anyplace. It's just life, things just aren't, that's the way things are, you know? So as soon as we form the intention to practice, you're faced with decisions. If you're going to sit for half an hour or more every day, then something else in your busy life has to be given up. You can't, it doesn't, We all have busy lives. Most of us have really busy lives, overly busy lives, probably. If I'm going to actually do this practice and consciously choose to sit for half an hour every day, what goes? What do I renounce? That I've done habitually that I enjoy, because typically the things we do habitually are the things we enjoy. Right? If I'm going to wake up with a clear mind in the morning, so you can practice, you have to go out and start going to bed a little earlier. Perhaps foregoing that party all your friends are going to. Because you know if you go to the party, you're going to get home really late and be kind of groggy in the morning, and your practice, it'll affect your practice. Oh, yeah. It might mean that you have to sort of change the people you hang with. And I'm not saying you have to sort of go around and tick, oh, no, can't be with that friend anymore. But just like the things you do and how you choose to do them is going to change. The more you get into the practice, the more that's what you have to do. If you're going to start sitting long retreats and you only have so many weeks of vacation time every year, oops, now I have to think, well, am I going to go on vacation and lie on the beach and or go with my family to the mountains or do whatever it is you like to do for vacation? And instead, have a time when I go by myself and do a more intense practice. I have to renounce something to be able to go on retreat. Even if it's just for a day. If that's like you're renouncing spending that day doing other stuff, being with your family, doing things that are fun, right? That's all about renunciation. It's simply you come to the understanding that practice is more important than most other things in our life. That's what's most important, is doing the practice. Which is a big leap for most people. And I'm not saying we should ignore our families, God forbid. But it's like we have to start going, I have to start making these choices that sometimes are going to make other people not so happy. But it's what I have to do because I have to practice. I want to read another section from Joseph here. This is the last piece. He's talking about recognizing our own addictions. I just spent time, I'm a hospital chaplain on Thursdays, and spent time talking to this poor man. He's 41. He's lost his family. He's totally addicted to opioids. What a sad life this man leads, just because he got addicted, basically. But we all, and what Joseph's pointing out here is, we all have addictions. Maybe not as severe as opioids, but we all have addictions. As we reflect on the drawback of sense pleasures and the rewards of renunciation, we often find difficulty even when we just hear the word renunciation, right? It can set off alarm bells within us, perhaps because we associate it with the repression of desire, with deprivation, with a rather bleak and austere lifestyle. So it's no wonder that our hearts don't leap up at the thought of it. We have to remember, the Buddha was called the happy one for a reason. He was a renunciate, but he was a very happy, led a very, very happy life. But a more accurate and liberating understanding of renunciation would be the experience of non-addiction. It's a really interesting way to look at it, non-addiction. We all know the suffering bound up with addictions, whatever they might be. We might be addicted in one way or another to food, drugs, sex, alcohol, or perhaps more unnoticed to work, power, recognition, wealth, or even comfort. We can become addicted to and entranced by certain mind states and emotions, like excitement or intensity or fear. Witness the very big audience for terrifying horror movies. We become addicted not only to the gratification of our wants, but also to the mental habits of wanting itself. There's a phenomena I call catalog consciousness. Have you ever found yourself casually opening a catalog that comes in the mail and turning the pages, just waiting for something to want? It's rare that we put down the catalog halfway through. We love to want, and we love the anticipation of fulfilling a want. Meditators can also get addicted to different mind states, like rapture or calm. How often in our practice are we trying to recreate some experience we've had before? We can get addicted to investigation. We can become overly fascinated with everything we're discovering. At one point in my own practice in Burma, when I had been there for several months, the mindfulness had become very sharp, and I was seeing extremely minute details about what was arising. When I reported this to Sayadaw Upandita, that's his teacher, thinking that things were going very well, all he said to me was, "Too attached to subtlety." Can you imagine hearing that? But it was a powerful reminder that the practice is about renunciation, about letting go. Everything in our practice is in the service of that. It is best summed up in one line of the Diamond Sutra: develop a mind that clings to nothing. Doesn't cling to anything. Develop a mind that doesn't cling to anything. So renounce, basically what he's saying is you have to renounce clinging. Which is an interesting thought. It's one way to get rid of clinging is to renounce it. So in this list I read a bit earlier, wholesome intention, we cultivate renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. Basically, with right intention, with wholesome intention, we start living our lives more or less, we start living for others more or less than for our limited selves, consciously choosing a life filled with loving kindness and compassion. We consciously choose, practice again. We consciously choose to live our lives thinking about the welfare of others. That's what the practices of loving kindness and compassion are. It's like, this is something that needs to be done in the world. This is how I need to, these are people I need to connect to in this way. I have to find ways where I can be useful in the world for others, not just for myself. Or at least less for myself and more for others. You got to be careful that you don't turn it into, I'm not important. Everybody else is important. I'm not important. That's a way to become a doormat, which also isn't very skillful. We have to remember that we have to take care of ourselves as well. So we have to shift that balance more towards thinking about and caring for others and less about caring for ourselves. It's a shift in the levels, not a on-off switch. And it means we start seeing that how everything's interconnected. If I create the causes and conditions so that someone else is happier, That means I'll be happier because we're all connected. Interesting way to think. If someone else becomes happier, the whole world becomes happier and I'm part of the whole world. Oh, it may not be so obvious, but it's a way we start to think about creating happiness in the world, making things better for others. And maybe happiness is too strong a word, at least it's making things better. You know, because there's a lot of things going on in this world that need to be made better, as we all know. So what can we do through practicing love and kindness and compassion to change how things are in the world for the better for people? That's a part of the whole wholesome intention, is making that sort of choice. We have to renounce, we have to give up the idea even that happiness comes from just getting stuff and avoiding stuff we don't want. And then we have to look at the world and go, oh, here's where I can bring about more happiness in the world. And those together are right intention. How we can, and so it's like, and notice that all of those things, I keep saying this, but it's really true. All these things are practices. These are things we have to practice. We have to practice these things. It isn't something that sort of just happens. You know, we don't, you know, this is what happens is we get caught thinking, oh, I'm a good person. I don't have to think about this anymore. What I'm saying is, no, yes, you're a good person, but you still need to think about these things all the time. You have to have right view and right intention at the top of our list of things we're being mindful of. Because mindfulness will allow us to see these things and go, oh, I can do this or I can do that. No, this makes more sense because this brings more happiness in the world. Okay. Of course, I have a piece of poetry to finish off. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And this is, I love this poem. It's called, Surely This Is Love. I'm intimately connected with all that is. When you water your roots, my heart blossoms. When I see you smile, that's when I know I'm fully alive. As you are able to live in truth, I raise the roof on this house I am exploring. I throw the doors wide, let the breeze blow in the windows. When you grow, I know it is my own opening. You stretch, I breathe. I give, and you receive. Just beneath the fabric of our lives, coiled, ready to spring or budding like a rose, reaching out to embrace or sitting bathed in grace and stillness, this singing, circling, radiant, one with everything. Surely this is love. What else needs to be said, huh?